Welcome to Season 5 of Game Design Unboxed on the No Direction Network. Danielle Reynolds talks to tabletop game designers about the games they've made. Together, they unbox how the game went from inspiration to publication.
This season is proudly sponsored by Allplay. If you've been following my social media, aka Token Gay Mer, you'll see that my Allplay gaming table gets used on the daily when I'm not flying to different conventions. Between hosting meals on it as a dining room table or removing the panels and adding the cup holders for a Friday night game night as a board gaming table, it gets used constantly. It's also perfect for being a working station for me building my ridiculous amount of prototypes. It honestly gets used more than I ever would have expected. Not to mention, it's great for hiding games and their pieces from my cats. Sans is my little box sitter, while Nova tries to steal the dice as Banshee watches from high atop the cat tower. I've caught them attempting to take dice from Allplay's Sequoia and Mountain Goats, two of my favorite Allplay games that my non-gamer friends adore. We play a lot of party games, and these two, they don't mind me taking out instead. So check out Allplay's tables, bags, playmats, and board games at allplay.com. Thank you for joining me, Danielle, for Game Design Unboxed, Inspiration to Publication, Episode 91, Buru. Today, we are joined by Alex Flagg, a designer and lead developer at Crafty Games. Thanks for being on the show.
Thanks for having me.
For anyone who doesn't already know you, would you mind just talking about how you got into designing games?
I started out in game design in probably 2000. I'd tinkered with games before, but, you know, kind of early-ish days of the internet. We were in the big surge of D20 and the kind of early D&D days, the Halcyon days. I was looking to, I really like John Woo movies and stuff like that. So I wanted to make a kind of action game. And you know, I was really into crime films and stuff. So I started out making this game called 10,000 Bullets, and I doing it as a D20, like bending the D&D rules to make more of a modern rule set. And I was going to self-publish this on the internet and kind of see if that led to anything, you know, if I could find some people that were interested in my stuff. I also had been tinkering with doing some mod teams in video games at the time, but what really wasn't getting a lot of creative juice out of it. And then I put it out there, ran across this game from Alderac Entertainment Group, or AEG. They put out a preview for a game called Spycraft, and it looked almost identical to the game that I was designing. And so I went to them cold and said, hey, you know, I've been doing mods for video games. What if I did a mod for your game? Because the thing I'm doing is very similar to yours, and you could just put it out free on your website. And this guy, Pat Capera, came back to me. He was like, sure, I guess, if you want to. So I started submitting files to him and saying, would this work? And what do you think? And they started going around the office there, and people got really kind of jazzed. And so like parts of the staff were started like, hey, we did a logo for you, you know, and hey, we really would like to see what you're going to do. The guys, so everybody kind of like, it kind of grabbed the staff's attention. And then I went to Gen Con that year. This was, I guess, 2002 by the time it came around, went to the last Milwaukee Gen Con, and I met the team in person, and I showed up with 150 pages of rules and laid it down in front of them. And like, I think I deprogrammed your game. Spycraft had come out that year. So I think I deprogrammed your game and rebuilt this stuff. And, you know, they're like, wow, okay. I was kind of hanging out with them because my first Gen Con, and they're like, yeah, this is Alex. You know, like he's done some stuff that we're going to put on the internet. Then it was like, this is Alex. I think we're going to hire him from some freelance work. And this is Alex. He's part of the design team.
Nice. I love it.
Yeah. So I kind of just like stumbled into it. I got inadvertently hired there, but I hit it off very well with everyone. And so that's how I entered the game industry. And then I worked as a freelancer and a stringer for AEG in its role-playing game days. So it, you know, prior to like 2005, 2006, they were only doing The Legend of the Five Rings card game and the role-playing games. And so, and they were doing the Spycraft line, and the Spycraft system at that point was generating a book every 6 weeks. So all the freelance team was small. So I was literally always working on a game, and we were turning them over in 6 weeks, turning over a 128-page role-playing game supplement. So kind of proved my quality, right, by just doing a lot of work, writing a lot, and we just generated rules. That game was so heavily in rules. And then we did, in 2004, we did Spycraft 2.0, a second version, because we burned ourselves through so much content. And then it came out, and then about 3 months later, AEG shuttered all its RPGs. They made a rather sudden pivot around that time and laid off a ton of staff. Patrick got laid off. And here of a game that's brand new, just come out, lots of critical accolades, and we're like kind of looking at each other. This is the thing we're all very proud of, and the industry is a buzz. And so like, we went to John Zinzer and said, hey, can we take this and start, use this as like sell this out through our own little shingle? And he said, sure. You know, we cut a deal with them, right? A licensing deal. And that's how Crafty Games began. And so in 2006, we opened Crafty Games, and then we start self-publishing there. So like I spent, you know, only like 3 years out there in the trenches, and then I became self-employed, and we started running our own shingle doing that. And so we carried on and did role-playing games, and then got Brandon Sanderson's Mistborn license in 2008, right before he got the Wheel of Time books to finish off. And then we built on that and did that for 10 years. This is our kind of last year of selling off stuff now. So, you know, we're doing that for, 15 years. And then we started to pivot into board games now.
That's so interesting. So you basically did what AEG did, where you went, let's do RPGs. Actually pivot.
Well, we did RPGs for a long time. I mean, yeah. We were a RPG only company until 2016 when we released Mistborn Houseware, based on the Mistborn novels. So yeah, so it's our first 11 years in business were just RPGs and house systems, stuff like that. Yeah.
So then let's switch over to our Spotlight game. How did the inspiration for this one start up?
Buru was actually the first outside board game we bought. And so, yeah, this is designed by Steven Wren, was the creator. And so he works for Panda Game Manufacturing. It was, I think, the first game he seriously pitched. And so he showed up at Gen Con. We had just launched or just finished the Houseware campaign, I believe. So we met him in 2016. And, you know, so he brought us this little game. And it's very, and I wasn't super knowledgeable in this, but it's this very, like, classic style Euro. We were really excited, so we bought it and, you know, really didn't have any idea about, like, doing development. I had not even finished my development work on the Mistborn game, the Mistborn Houseware board game. So, yeah, we kind of delved into this one. So, yeah, so Steven brought us the game in 2016. We started, like, looking at it, but the game had a lot of, there's a ton of things we really liked about it, specifically the core mechanic of bidding and stuff. But there was always, we sensed that there was some structural things, like it was imbalanced the way that the flow of the game worked. And so I started as developing and working in the game and kind of getting in there. But as we got further into it, you know, realized that there was like more structural work that needed to be done. And so a couple of years into the process, we kind of took the game, stripped it back down to its parts, and then rebuilt it up and smoothed out the systems and the flows of everything. So yeah, I started as a developer. I became a co-designer because we did so much structural work and kind of took all of Steven's core ideas and built around his core mechanic and the concept of Buru as a place and everything, and then rejiggered it and rebuilt a lot of the mechanics around the core and then into the version that we have now. So yeah, it was a exceptionally long process for this game. You know, normally I think a development on a game, and I mean, Daniel, you can speak to this, your experience here, but you know, development for us on a game will usually take in somewhere in the order of 2 to 4 years. It depends on how complex and how much work there needs to be done. And this is all the way through, I'd say, until you have creative assets finished. In the case of Buru, it took more like 7 years. So, or 6 or 7 years. So it's quite long because we're learning as we're doing.
No, that totally makes sense. So then with the version that is currently out in print that you can play, how do you play the game for anyone who's never played?
So Buru itself, it now plays a lot like a kind of like 2000s era Euro, meaning it's not like, you know, hey, here's a drab board with, you know, like a million different mechanics that kind of loosely are linked and point salad scoring and some dour person in period garb staring at you from the cover or whatever. This is a game where it's really about, it's much more highly interactive, or it's interactive in the way that games like Raw or El Grande are. So you have it's a competitive bidding game, but it's a blind bidding game, which you don't see too often. So you've got 5 explorers. These are numbered from 1 to 5, representing their strength of the bid. And you're going to place them in the center of the board, which represents the island of Buru. You place them in the wilderness face down. So people know where you've bid, but not what you've bid. You bid until you've got 4 of your 5 pieces out there, or until you only have 1 piece left. You're playing the expansion. And then the last person on your is left generates fish. They go fishing, they stay on your boat. And then starting at the forest and going around, you start revealing your bids. What you're bidding for is actions, and the area in which you bid is the type of actions you're bidding for. So in the forest, you're bidding for collecting resources. In the shore, you're bidding for collecting cards to add to your engine. So these are islanders that you're hiring. At the village, you're turning on a number of those islanders, giving them tasks to go out and help you. Then at the Sacred Lake, you are going to convert all those resources and the powers of those islanders to pay tribute to the spirits of the island. And the goal being to collect the highest esteem out of the people there, victory points. So what you're doing is effectively every turn is about setting up a scoring. The bids, because everybody has the same kind of spread of pieces, and you know, you only get 1-5 and you only get 1-4, you've got to kind of carefully balance everything in your choices. And then on top of this is a layer. When you win an area, you collect a totem for that space. So when you have the totem, when people are paying tribute, if someone pays tribute to the spirit whose totem you hold, you also collect a point. So if you are setting up your own scoring, let's say I wanted to pay tribute to Banyu, which is the spirit associated with the shore space. The best way to maximize my scoring is to win in the shore and then also pay tribute to that spirit in the turn. So sometimes it'll be obvious, like the players can spot that and try to counterbid you and scrape some points off of you. So that's sort of some of the observation and triangulation you have to do as you play. It's not a super complicated game, though. You know, like most of what's happening in the game is happening right in front of you, mostly, except for your bids. Pretty much everything is open information. So it's really about observing opportunities, jumping in there, trying to kind of get in the way of other people. And it ends up, you know, when people are familiar with the game, it plays a lot like Mahjong. You know, like people are slapping their explorers down because these are chunky pieces of wood. So bap, 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 bap. They all kind of have a plan. And then you see how it pans out. So it's you know, not hard to play, but it's nice. It's engaging. It's interactive. And you get some surprises in there.
What made you think up the theme, or I guess made the initial designer think up the theme?
It's interesting because what I try to do here, a lot of my work is in thematic design. You know, like we'll get games we find are mechanically interesting, but a lot of times we have to kind of reconfigure and lay theme on, you know, because if you're doing role-playing games, those are theme-first games, right? People are trying to simulate, you know, a fantasy delve with monsters, or they're trying to simulate being super spies or something like that. So, you know, I think about games from a thematic and player engagement side. Like, why do people want to get this thing out? What are they trying to pull out? So in the case of Buru, Steven had an idea for the mechanics, and then he picked the name of an island and then put it on the game, and that's what came to us. So it was very, like, he kind of knew he wanted, you know, 4 or 5 spaces, and so then he did some research and, you know, kind of, you know, okay, this area is going to be the shore and this area is going to be the mountain, and, you know, and then he associated stuff. But when it came down to like determining spirits and stuff like that, you know, he had just kind of made up stuff, you know, like he just came up with some names that he thought sounded thematic. And so the game that was brought to us thematically was, you know, like it kind of this meeting of two worlds. Like he wanted to have this experience of a kind of proto Polynesian people and a proto Melanesian people, which would be occupying places like in Indonesia, meeting. And he had kind of set it around the Ice Age, or like at the time where the seas were lower because there was the Ice Age. You know, I did some research. It didn't make any sense. Like there was nothing. Like the Polynesian diaspora really didn't even occur until about, you know, between 300 and 400 years ago. So they wouldn't have been there, and certainly not around the Ice Age. So I went back to the drawing board and said, you know, let's dive deeper into this theme. And what we ended up pulling up is the era of the Majapahit. So that was, this is kind of the Indonesian golden age, but this set up very nicely thematically, because this is a time where you have this enormous, like, you have this kingdom that's geographically larger than the Roman Empire at its height. So it's huge, covers all of modern Indonesia. And this is an era where this kingdom was expanding. It was not doing so like through fire and sword. And it was, you know, building a lot of relationships with people through trade and stuff like that. And so I was able to kind of take Stephen's goal of having this meeting of cultures and this first encounter and the interactions, how do you win these people over, and then put it in the context of that. And then we use that to kind of, we built out of that core, we built this much as thematically as we could. You know, all the spirits' names are actual Indonesian words because the people of the Buru are animists. So they believe in spirits of things, but they don't have names so much, right? So like Gunung means mountain. There's a big old mountain in there that's sacred to the people of Buru. There's the, you know, Banyu is the water. And there's the sacred lake there is very important to the folks that live on that island. Manuk means birds. Manuk is the people of Buru, as I've read it, believe that birds are spirits of ancestors who passed on. So that was another thing we could use. And so as much as possible, I tried to lean towards the Indonesian-ness of it and fold it together through a kind of consistent lens, that this is the lens, you know, we're playing the explorers coming from Majapahit who are trying to basically be the person who is the, I'm going to say, ambassador to the island itself. So they're kind of be the representative Majapahit on the island. That's kind of the theme. And then the words are using Indonesian words, and because that's their perspective on things. The decrees you get, the kind of random objectives that come up, are the king asking you to do stuff while you're there, and so on and so on and so on. So, and then we kind of back that up with our art choices and things like that.
Okay. Yeah, that's very interesting since you are basing it off of like the 14th century empire. But also, did you end up like hiring someone to do that research, or like a cultural consultant?
Yes, we did. So yeah, that was very important for us. And this is a kind of an important thing for us going forward. So Patrick and I have realized that we like Euros, and we like Euros of this particular type. And the games that we are kind of consistently seeing and licensing were Euro styles, but of this sort of earlier era. So yeah, I went to college at Bullitt College in Wisconsin. It's a big anthropology school, cultural and archaeological. And we had lots and lots of kind of training about cultural values and you know, like contextual things, right? And so like I always approach theme also with how it's going to ring in terms of authenticity. It's my personal mission, right, to make these things as authentic as possible and as true as we can while still having a good game. Majapahit is a very big deal in Indonesia. This is a, you know, it's kind of a point of national pride. Like I compare it to like Italians being proud of the era of Caesar and kind of the height of Rome and the glory of Rome. And, you know, there's kids comics about it, you know, like long running comics about it and stuff like that. And there's a whole cultural preservation society that's a national organization. So we actually went to them first, tried to see what they could, if we could work with them to get information. And I figured that would make the research easier. I never heard back, you know, we're nobody. And so I ended up reaching out to a number of times, cold, went to some academics, kind of ran into a wall. I had some friends who are like, oh, I know people who do Southeast Asian studies, maybe they shouldn't. And so again, I kept running into walls. Finally, I went out and started reaching out to game companies out of Indonesia. And so through that process, I met the guys who had started Ketchup Games, specifically Chris Adiranto, and he's out of Jakarta. He was really interested in this idea. He's a big time game enthusiast and a publisher of stuff. And so we started working with him. So, you know, Chris knew the language, and, you know, and we thought, oh, maybe we'll get it. Maybe they'll be interested in bringing the game to Indonesia itself. So through the process, Chris started doing a bunch of research because he knew people who were in academia. And so he kind of built a little team and they consulted on us. And yeah, as we got into this process, you know, like we said, hey, Chris, do you want to bring this out, you know, in Indonesia? Do you want to do an Indonesian version? And he's like, well, you know, we don't really have the money. It's kind of a big, you know, we do smaller stuff. And I said, well, would you be willing to translate the game? And he said, sure. You know, and so we said, we'll just put Indonesian rules in the box. And so we ended up having Chris did the translation, you know, and then we just included Indonesian rules. So folks anywhere in the world that speak Indonesian or are Indonesian can play the game. That, you know, I wanted to be sure that the folks in the space that we're drawing inspiration from and trying to, you know, be authentic to also had access to the game. And so, you know, like we just put that straight into the game. Similarly, and this was good luck. So we have Dan May from Quill Silver has been our graphic designer on this game. He's fantastic, incredibly skilled guy. He knows lots of people. And when we were looking for artists and we were kind of going through styles, I was thinking of, you know, the shadow puppet style, the kind of classic, if you have Wayang Kulit, if you've ever seen an Indonesian shadow puppet play.
Mm-hmm.
And, you know, he was like, I could probably do something with that, but let me see who I know. And it turns out he knows a guy named Enggar Adarasa, who is an Indonesian artist. Enggar was thrilled about the idea. He's really into Indonesian history. And so he came back to us and he said, do you know, have you ever seen the style of the friezes that are on the remaining temples and structures from Majapahit itself? They have kind of this flattened style, not quite like a Egyptian hieroglyphs, but, you know, like it's kind of like flattened perspective and very distinctive. And he's like, what if I did something like that? And it's this really unique art style. And so we're like, yeah, that's great. And we went to something really saturated. I knew I wanted something colorful that popped and felt like Southeast Asian. And he just dove in and we kind of gave him his head and he came back with this fantastic style. And then Dan embellished it with his graphic design work. You know, he designed the board and the iconography. And, you know, we worked and looked into all these kind of influences and put it all together. So, you know, getting an artist out of that Indonesian artist and then getting Indonesian cultural consultants who are familiar with games and with the history and things like that. And the kind of all the little things that a Westerner is just not going to see really kind of was an alchemy for making the game come together.
Now, I think that's so amazing, especially to take in consideration adding that into the rule book or like making a separate rule book for it, because that's not something that happens all that often. I know that I typically say I enjoy Euro games. I love them, especially the ones that are based around like historical events or just areas of the world that I maybe haven't traveled to. And it's so cool to passively learn and actually know that you took the time to make sure some of that was like more accurate or at least like reflects the type of people or the type of area or culture that should be represented. So I think that's really cool.
Yeah, thank you.
When you were going about designing and just like making it more thematic, what kind of like changes did you make from the initial design that Steven proposed to you? I know you kind of touched on a few, but I'd love to hear more.
I think one of the, you know, the big things was figuring out like what was in play and what wasn't. And that sort of informed everything else. We had a decision point where we had to choose, you know, were we going to go thematic? Or like historically thematic, or were we going to go a completely different direction and try to build around the mechanics as they were? Because I think, you know, as a developer, and I'm sure you've had this experience too, is like that you've got a game that works, but the theme is not clicking, right? And so if you have to retheme it, you have to figure out, try to like rescaffold around the existing structure you've got without touching anything. So find a justification for like, why are they scoring points by doing this? You know? And so, you know, we went back and forth about it and there was kind of there was a pretty long discussion. We had a second developer, Taryn Kratz, who's here in Portland. So Taryn and I and Steven like bounced these things around for quite a bit, trying to kind of get our heads around how to make it all work and what worked and what wasn't clicking the way we wanted it to. And I think it wasn't about redoing Steven's mechanics, certainly at that point thematically. It was just trying to find every piece to match logically. Because, I mean, when we think about games, we think about mechanics. We think about, you know, okay, well, this is a deck builder and this has got worker placement, da 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 da. And or we think about math. But when we talk about games and when we sell games, we always talk about theme, right? Like you tell why, who are you? Why are you doing this thing? Why is this game an experience you want to have for an hour or an hour and a half today? So I really want to make sure that everything thematically came together from that perspective and that people could talk in like kind of fairly plain language about a mechanical construct so it clicked. And so I think, you know, yeah, there was the spirits and the gods. Like we had like when I realized that none of this timeline stuff that Steven had kind of just threw together, really, he wasn't trying to pass that off as a representation. It was just, he's like, this sounds interesting and these names sound interesting, and he didn't really know much about it. And so that was my job, was to find out about it and get into it. And then we had kind of a second pass. So we did that, kind of got those pieces in place. And so here's the context. And then in the second pass, Taryn did a development run where he did a lot of structural changes about how the turns worked. The totem mechanic that we have wasn't like that. Originally, it was all tied to having majorities of cards. So the effectively all the Islanders had suits on them. And so there would be intermittent scoring in which we would determine, okay, who has the most canoe tribe people and who had the most, because they were just represented by icons, who had the most grass tribe people. It was like a whole, like the game ground to a halt, and we stopped and counted cards, and we had to look at everybody else's tableaus to see what they had. And that wasn't working. So Taryn had the idea to push the totems into the spaces and kind of integrate this into the core of the bidding mechanic. So that was a big one. And so we pushed the totems, made them the big old chunky wood pieces that they are now. He built the model out of Legos, right? So now we had a stand-up element that everybody could see. It was very easy now to tell who had the favor of which of the spirits. It also made it much more dynamic. It was a huge improvement on the game. And then there was the, like, after that was done and we kind of restructured, I started pushing out the actions from areas where they had been weighted. You know, like the Steven's original design was like, you had a lot of, you had to get tokens to pay tribute. So it's just a currency you had to spend, but you had to spend it later in the turn. And then you had to, you know, collect resources, and you had to go here. And then you go to this one space where you did everything. So that meant at the end of the end, you had like action points, you'd spend them across a series of actions. So I took that and I kind of redispersed that around the board. And then we built this, instead of having you like spend points, now you're buying packages of actions. So this was where kind of the bidding really locked in and became much more important, because you're not just trying to win an area, you're trying to win the totem of that area, and you're also trying to win the best package of abilities for yourself. That was a big, again, it was using all the pieces that Steven had had, but repackaging them in a new way so that the game became much smoother and much more accessible, and you didn't have this kind of, I won't call it imbalance, but like where it's heavily weighted, like part of the board is very useful in the early game, part of the board is extremely useful at the end of the game. And so now it's the whole thing plays much more smoothly, and it kind of frees players up to attack the game as they will throughout the game without having to know, okay, I need to make a heel turn. You know, in turn three, I need to start favoring shore actions. You know, some of those things are going to happen naturally, but it's not like it was where it was just hugely important to play a game a very certain way. So that's kind of how all this stuff flew together.
And what made you decide to take on the design for Crafty Games as a publisher?
I lead with my heart. I think that was one of those things where it was our very first design we had purchased from somebody else. So we, you know, everything had been built internally. Mistborn House was a spec design from Kevin Wilson that we brought in. Kevin's an old friend of ours. So this is the first time we went out there and somebody brought us something. We played it and we just really liked it, even though we didn't know even necessarily why we liked it. But there was something there and it felt right. And so we pretty much decided on site that we wanted it. And so I think that that's maybe not the most useful answer for somebody that's out there pitching. But I think if your game can connect, even being raw and even being new and even maybe not being perfectly balanced or playtested or whatever, but if it can connect with a person in that way, it connect with the publisher in a way that they may be interested in doing the work of taking this kind of diamond in the rough and polishing it up and adding the facets it needs, you know, that really speaks to the strength of a design. So yeah, we liked the bidding mechanic. We liked the explore mechanic and the 1-5 pieces. We liked kind of the vibe and the flow of the game. And it was just about getting that flow to work, making the theme work, making things feel balanced, making feel where people, you know, that all those little things around it that makes the game experience when on reflection feel better, right? That, you know, I had a good time. I want to play it again. Like I didn't play it poorly or didn't miss something entirely or, oh God, I'm so stupid, I didn't even see that. That was what our job was. So yeah, we fall in love a little bit less now, now that we have some experience.
You've dated around, you know what happens. You're like, I want them a little bit more.
But when you're starting out, you don't necessarily know what you're publishing, what you just kind of know what you like and your taste sort of guides you there. And so we were willing to do the work to see if this was a game that was right for us. And it turned out it has really kind of been formative for where we ended up going long term.
That's so great, because you mentioned that game was, what, like 6 years? Is that inspiration to publication? So like getting a pitch, grabbing it, and having it out to people? Or was that not including the time it was taking to print and stuff? How long was it in total?
So it came out the very beginning of this year. Yeah, I guess it's 7 years all told, like with production and everything included in there. It went on Kickstarter in 2021, and it was basically done. I think I did my last work on it in 2021. I did some post-Kickstarter edit, rulebook edits, but then we had a very long production cycle.
Makes sense. Well, then from the experience, what was your favorite and least favorite part?
My favorite part, I really loved working with Steven and Taryn on this project. I really liked getting like elbows deep in this game and having the conversations and really kind of, for me, my favorite part, I suppose, was finding that thematic core, which kind of spun out and formed everything else. Like we spent a lot of time kind of going around, what does this need to be? You know, this is a very obscure place. The people of Beru themselves don't have a written history. So it's all oral history. And so the island itself is best known as a prison island for Sahardo's regime. So like there's a lot that you don't know about that place. So it was like really tough to research. But when it started to come together, when we kind of landed in the Majapahit Pahit theme, when I got in there and did the reading and did the stuff and then started seeing how this could naturally inform stuff and watching it all come together from the art side and with Chris and his team's help to kind of finally cohere into a single thing, that was my favorite part. It's like that's the kind of the magic that happens, right? Is that the right people were in the right places and we hit it in just the right way. I think my least favorite part has probably been fulfillment. The fulfillment side has been there was a lot of hiccups that happened in the middle because of issues with outside vendors and stuff like that. And so it's been the fulfillment process is like going to be nearly 6 months long. And it's crazy. And production was a similarly challenging thing. There was a lot like the production itself, the final result looks amazing. You know, Wutz did a great job with the manufacturing, but there were a lot of issues in the making of the individual parts that added a year of time to the process. So it just became very difficult. I think it's just like the waiting is the hardest part, right? Like you get this thing all done, you're done in 2021, you figure it's going to be out in 22, it's going to be out in early 23, it's going to be a lot late 23, it's going to be out in early 2024, you know, it's just, that's very tough.
No, that definitely makes sense. I know, especially COVID messed up a lot of stuff with fulfillment and just shipping in general. Well, so as far as like giving advice to designers, I want to do it through the lens of you took on a game that was not fully like done. So you did kind of development that worked into basically being a co-designer. So in your experience of doing something like that, so maybe you are a designer that needs something fixed, so they added a co-designer. But like, what would your advice be in that situation as to like how to cooperate with someone who already has an initial idea, but you know you're like coming from a good place and communicating to try to make it a better product, but you don't want to step on toes, you don't want to take it over, but you want to work with them. What would be your advice for how to collaborate?
Everything's a negotiation. And I don't mean that in a hostile way, but you know, really, it's a conversation. It's a long running conversation. And the more development work that you need done, the more detailed and longer and sometimes more difficult that conversation is. So I was very lucky in this space. Steven was he has other things to do. He has other games he wanted to do. So he was happy to leave it with us. And he trusted us. And then we would do check-ins. So the way we did this is, we rarely worked all on the same thing at the same time. We lateraled a lot. And so it was, he'd do an iteration on, say, the expansion. He'd bring it to me. I would play test it. I would look at it. I would tinker with it. I'd give him notes. He'd send, and then we'd kind of kick it back and forth. But, you know, at some point we realized around the time we brought Taryn on that, like, it's just not, we're not getting where we want. Like, we kind of felt we were spinning our wheels and we're just, you know, changing house paint. But the problem is the bones of the house. And so I think everybody was open to doing a more radical look at what we could do. And so that's where Taryn came in. And Taryn was he was the house builder, right? So he did a lot of work to kind of tear things down and build it up. So I think really it's about communication and it's about not being super possessive. I know that, you know, when you make a game, it's your baby and you can be precious about it. But as a developer who works on everything. And usually I'm approaching things as thematic. Like I approach theme first, but a lot of times my job is specifically to make the theme click with the game, if nothing else. And so that means doing the research and coming back and pushing back on maybe some, not mechanical decisions, but making this thing all fly together thematically. And, you know, I was very fortunate. Everybody was open to listening to that. And I think you need to have that sort of generosity to hear what people are saying. It's like, it's not a criticism of your game. Everybody's interested in making that thing better. And ultimately, if you think as a designer that they are not being true to what your game is or what it should be, then maybe you need to have a conversation about taking the design back, you know, because sometimes people will want to contort everything into their house brand or their, you know, sci-fi theme or whatever. And that doesn't work for every game. Like, you know, I approach development. I want my theme to work, but I start by using the mechanics to inform the theme. And so really the game is still leading the way, but sometimes people are saying like, you know, we're going to do this as a Star Trek game. And if your game's not true to Star Trek or whatever, like the audience is going to know. And as a designer, that will reflect on their opinion about what you did. And so if something's not just genuinely not working in that way, then, you know, maybe it's time to have the harder conversation about, is this game right for what you want to do with it, Mr. Publisher? And have that conversation. I think if you approach that type of conversation with openness and some trust that they want to also see this game published because they've invested in it too, you might be pleasantly surprised with what comes out.
Yeah, no, I agree. I think that's awesome. And then for you as Crafty Games, what kind of things should people be looking out for?
Well, so we've done Buru. It's delivered. You know, the last things are on the boats now. We're also bringing our first game over from a foreign publisher. It's called Sardinia. It's it's coming from Platy Games out of Korea. This is actually a re-implementation of an old Stefan Dora game, Creta. So it's beautiful. Absolutely gorgeous art. They have a fantastic team of artists there. Jung-hee, the publisher, is a super smart guy. He's been able to pick up really kind of interesting designs. And the cool thing is it all folds up into its own little magnetic box. So it looks great. It's compact. And then just when you open it up, it just explodes out onto the table. So, and it's another like classic Euro you kind of an area control and prediction investment movement game. So it's super cool. Tabriz from Randy Flynn of Cascadia fame. We were the first people who bought designs from him. So Tabriz is another game that has a similar vibe. It's a kind of classic style Euro, contract fulfillment, meeple movement, beautiful 36 inch long player mat in every box, kind of like a light to midweight side of sending your little guys running around the market trying to fill carpets in this famous rug making capital of Tabriz in Iran. And so that's going to come out also. Similarly, we had a Persian-American artist, Sid Finney, working on that game. The rules are presented in English and Persian in every box. It's also coming in 8 other languages beyond that. So that's going to be a big one in the very last stages of production. So we're just making some changes. We're going to make sure everybody gets an insert and making a couple small tweaks to the box so it fits into a Kallax. But we're nearly done with those. And so we should be pushing the button anytime now. So that's a big one. Just recently on the BGG Hotness, we had a future game from us, from Johnny Pack of Coloma, Endless Winter, Unconscious Mind, many, many others, called Knights of the Round Table. So we're working on that right now. That'll be coming out. That'll be coming to crowdfunding sometime in first half of 2025, we believe.
Damn, sounds like you got some good stuff coming up in the near future. And then I guess my last question, unrelated to you designing or working on these projects, is if you could have been the designer of any game that you didn't make, what would it be?
You know, there's the publisher answer, which is, I love the thing that was the most successful. Like, maybe I would have said years ago, I would have said Cards Against Humanity because it just made a raft of money. But I think as a designer, developer, the game I'm kind of in love with right now is Hegemony by Hegemonic Games. It is a very complex, asymmetrical game in which you are playing social classes. And to me, is like, I still haven't finished a game, but I've played it 4 times, but I haven't actually played a game all the way through. It's mind-blowing. As a sociologist, as a designer, I find it amazing because the interaction of It was designed by people who were thesis students. I believe they're political, definitely in the social sciences. So, you know, you have the working class, the middle class, the capitalists, and it's really kind of capitalism, and then the state. And so, like, watching how these different classes, the incentives bounce off each other, you know, all the workers are coming from the working class and the middle class. Capitalism has the businesses, so like they create businesses, but then they need to staff them with people. So it means there has to be enough workers. And then, you know, one of the big things in the game is like pushing and pulling politics, which is not framed in like a straight left-right context. They just have policies, but these policies very naturally channel different ways. So you're trying to push and pull policy, and then the state is meanwhile trying to sort of appease and build legitimacy for itself by doing things for the classes themselves, almost like bribing them. And it's like you look at it and it's a lot to take in. But then when you see it working and you see the way people play that game and what they do, you know, the player who's doing the working class is going to actually, the player will start playing the game in a certain way because the incentive structures and the things they need for their class to succeed versus the capitalists, you know, who are just there to generate, to launder, effectively launder money, revenue into capital, which they want to protect at all times. And how they play that game, it moves so naturally. People don't even know that they're playing into, I'd say, stereotypes, because the incentives are so well designed within the system, and the way that they bounce off each other feels very authentic and real. So yeah, it's a heavy game, but it's a game that makes people play naturally in a way that is extremely authentic to what they're trying to do. And I find that incredibly impressive.
Yeah, no, I mean, that's the signs of a good design. I remember it being up for quite a few awards. I don't know if it actually ended up winning any of them last year.
Yeah, I don't know either. I mean, but it's a first design. It's in a ton of different languages. Like, it really broke out. And it's big publishers that picked it up, right? Like, CMON got it. I think it's one of those games where it's a sleeper, and it seems very dry, you know, and the board itself looks very dry. It looks kind of like a spreadsheet. But when if you give it a chance, like, and especially as a social science person, like, it just, every time I play it, like, kind of blows my mind watching players fall so naturally into these roles and the situations that bubble up out of it.
Cool. I'll add it to my list. Thank you to everyone who's been listening to this episode of Game Design Unboxed, Inspiration to Publication, episode 91, Buru. And also thanks, Alex, for being on the show. For anyone trying to find you or Crafty Games, where can they find you?
Best places to find us are probably Facebook at facebook.com/craftygames. That's all one word. Or on Twitter at twitter.com/craftygames. However long Twitter lasts.
Twitter X, whatever it's called. That's funny. Yeah, you can also find me, your host, Danielle Reynolds, on social media under Instagram, X, Blue Sky, under the same username. It's Token Gamer, and that's spelled G-A-Y-M-E-R. Thanks again for being on the show. This was super great.
Yeah, it was super fun.
Thank you for joining Danielle for another episode of Game Design Unboxed, Inspiration to Publication. If you'd like to hear more great gaming podcasts, check out nodirectionpodcast.com. And if you're looking for a great board game, bag, playmat, or table, check out All Play at letsallplay.com. Join us next time.